content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the June 28th, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a scene. I'm guessing it must be Venice, Italy. It's a bridge over a river. There are all kind of gondolas in the water, and the one in the foreground is sinking. There's a helicopter in the sky and a drone and a couple of people parachuting. There are just hundreds and hundreds of people on the bridge overlooking the water, and even it looks like one couple has fallen off the bridge trying to take a selfie of themselves. And the title is Far Too Popular: Why Summer Destinations Are Rebelling Against Over-Tourism. And we'll pick that up later on the Talking Points page, but we'll start with this main story. Escalating tensions with Iran. What happened? Tensions between the U.S. and Iran reached new heights this week as Tehran announced that it would increase its nuclear fuel stockpile past the limit it agreed to in the 2015 nuclear deal, while President Trump deployed 1,000 more American troops to the Middle East. The latest escalation in the conflict came after the U.S. accused Iran's Revolutionary Guards of launching attacks that crippled two oil tankers belonging to Japan and Norway in the Gulf of Oman. The Defense Department released grainy video purportedly showing the crew of an Iranian patrol boat removing an unexploded mine from one of the tankers. Iran denied any involvement, but has launched similar attacks in the past. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that the U.S. does not want war, but warned that any action by Iran that kills a single U.S. service person will trigger a military counterattack. Iran demanded that European nations provide relief from punishing American sanctions imposed since last year, when the Trump administration pulled out of the nuclear agreement negotiated by the Obama administration. Iran and the European signatories have stayed in the pact, but Iran now says that without sanctions relief, it will violate the agreement and accelerate its enrichment and stockpiling of uranium, and may even start enriching higher-grade uranium that could be used for developing nuclear weapons. What the editorial said. Tehran's provocations were entirely predictable, said the Washington Post. After withdrawing from the Obama administration's nuclear deal, the Trump administration abandoned diplomacy for a maximum pressure campaign designed to economically cripple Iran. Retaliation was inevitable. The White House has offered Tehran only one off-ramp, a list of 12 demands to completely change its foreign policy with no concessions from the U.S. Trump sounds sincere when he says he does not want a war, but has backed himself into a dangerous corner on Iran. Iran is the bad actor here, said the Wall Street Journal. Tehran used the financial windfall from Obama's short-sighted nuclear deal to fund its ballistic missile program at home and spread terror abroad through its proxy wars in Yemen and Syria. President Trump was right to try to force Iran back to the negotiating table. Tehran's tantrum should convince European leaders to join Trump's campaign to isolate Iran instead of clinging to the remnants of the nuclear deal. What the columnist said. Don't expect Europe to follow Trump's lead, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. The current crisis is exactly what European leaders feared when they begged Trump not to unilaterally pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Now they are hesitant to join a confrontation they say was wholly avoidable and in part manufactured by the White House. Trump is definitely in an awkward position, said Elliot Hannon in Slate.com. The White House is now demanding that Tehran comply with an agreement the American president has not only derided, but pulled out of. That agreement may not have been perfect, but the Obama administration knew that half a loaf, no Iranian nuclear development for 15 years, was better than none. That feeling you have right now is nostalgia for competence. If the U.S. doesn't respond to Iranian provocations, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com, we are asking to be blackmailed. Holding Iran accountable for its actions doesn't require a full-scale invasion, a limited strike on Iranian naval facilities, or a few well-placed cruise missiles would send the right message. But what's the end game here, asked Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Trump has veered wildly between making maximalist threats, such as tweeting that he could officially end Iran, and calling for talks with the Supreme Leader. The president killed the nuclear deal just to prove he could one-up President Obama, but with no coherent idea what to do next. Now we have tankers being attacked, a U.S. carrier group on patrol in the region, the Iranian nuclear program on the verge of restarting, and a dangerous crisis building. Trump appears to be approaching this like someone who plays a commander-in-chief on TV. Controversy of the week is titled, Trump Inviting More Foreign Election Meddling. President Trump has gone from no collusion to pro-collusion, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com. In a stunning admission to ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos, Trump said that he'd accept a foreign government's offer of dirt on his political opponents in the 2020 election. There's nothing wrong with listening, Trump said. If somebody called me from a country like Norway saying, we have information on your opponent, oh, I think I'd want to hear it. Trump expressed ambivalence about notifying the FBI and challenged FBI Director Christopher Wray's recent statement that the Bureau should be told if a campaign were contacted by a foreign power trying to influence an election. The FBI director is wrong, Trump said. It was bad enough when Trump publicly invited Russian operatives to meddle in the 2016 campaign by asking them to find Hillary Clinton's deleted emails, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. But now Trump is declaring his intent to repeat the very same conduct that led to 2 years of investigation. Our commander-in-chief just told us that he is willing to betray his country to win re-election. Trump's critics are hypocrites, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. The Trump campaign was itself a victim of foreign interference. The Australian government and several European nations funneled unverified intelligence to the Obama administration that the Trump campaign might be getting help from the Russian government. That kicked off an FBI probe that evolved into the special counsel investigation. Those countries had their own anti-Trump agendas, fearing his NATO-bashing isolationism. The Democratic-funded Steele dossier, which the Obama administration used to justify wiretapping Trump campaign aides, was put together by a former British intelligence agent, Christopher Steele, using sources in Russia. So when a Republican benefits from foreign help, it's treason. When a Democratic administration gets a tip from a foreign power, it uses it to open an FBI investigation into its Republican opponents. What a despicable distortion, said Michael Tomasky in DailyBeast.com. It's perfectly legal to hire private foreign contractors for opposition research if you're paying a fair market rate and disclose that relationship, as the Clinton campaign did with Steele. Steele had previously cooperated with the CIA and FBI through his work for the British government, our closest ally. He used Russian sources in his investigation because he was looking into a Russian plot. But he was working against Kremlin interests. It's absurd to compare that to the Trump campaign's eager acceptance of help from hostile foreign powers, including Democratic Party emails stolen by Russian military hackers. Campaign law forbids accepting anything of value from foreigners seeking to influence an election. Actually, the law is murkier than Trump's opponents like to pretend, said Jacob Sullum in Reason.com. It's not clear that negative information about election rivals counts as a thing of value under campaign finance law. Even Robert Mueller admits in his report that this proposition has never been tested in court. To clarify this issue once and for all, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post, congressional lawmakers have put forward several bipartisan bills to strengthen election security, including requiring campaigns to report any offer of foreign assistance. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said he will block all such legislation from even receiving a vote. Trump is openly inviting another attack on our political system, but it's McConnell who is making it an inevitability. It's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for it. When President Trump paid tribute to First Lady Melania's style by comparing her favorably to Jackie Kennedy Onassis. We have our own Jackie O today. It's called Melania, Trump told Fox News. Melania. We call it Melania T. Okay? It was a good week for home defense after Braden Smith, 11, of North Carolina, fought off a three-person home invasion by attacking one of the burglars with a machete. He noticed that he was bleeding in the back of the head really badly, Smith said later, so he just dropped everything and ran out of the door. And it was a good week for Salah Schneider after the 10-year-old Colorado girl became the youngest person to climb El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. I was scared just sometimes, said Schneider, whose rock climbing parents fell in love on El Capitan. I thought it was really fun. But it was a bad week for sticking your neck out after two giraffes at the Lion Country Safari Park in Florida were killed by the same bolt of lightning. Park officials said the odds of this happening were 1 billion to 1. It was a bad week for blaming your wife after U.S. Representative Duncan Hunter's spouse, Margaret, changed her plea and admitted that she and her husband illegally used more than $200,000 in campaign funds as their personal bank account. Margaret Hunter now will testify against her husband, who last year said, "She handled my finances." And finally, it was a bad week for promotions after a Miami bar withdrew its offer of free shots for every goal scored by the U.S. Women's World Cup soccer team during the team's 13-0 thrashing of Thailand. Our free shots promotion is not meant to be taken literally, explained a bar spokesman. On the briefing page now, titled, The Origins of the Russia Investigation. Attorney General William Barr wants to find out why the Russia probe began. What's already known? When did the investigation start? The FBI began probing the Trump campaign's connections to Russia on July 31, 2016, based on an alarming tip from the Australian government. 2 months earlier, Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos had told Australia's top diplomat in London over drinks that the Russian government had dirt on Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and might release the information to help the Trump campaign. The diplomat, Alexander Downer, thought Papadopoulos was too young and inexperienced to have any real influence in a presidential campaign, but notified his superiors. When WikiLeaks began releasing hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee on July 22nd, the Australian ambassador to the U.S. informed American officials of what Papadopoulos had said. Days later, the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation, codenaming the operation Crossfire Hurricane. What did the FBI investigate? The unusual ties of several Trump campaign aides to Russia. The earlier investigation focused on Papadopoulos, as well as Trump's senior advisor Michael Flynn, campaign manager Paul Manafort, and foreign policy advisor Carter Page. Flynn had been paid $45,000 by Russia's state-sponsored television network RT for a 2015 speech in Moscow, where he was given a place of honor at the same dinner table as President Vladimir Putin. Manafort had been paid millions lobbying for pro-Russian interests in Ukraine. Page, an oil industry consultant who had lived in Russia for 3 years during the early 2000s, was already well known to the FBI. Russian spies had attempted to recruit him as an asset in 2013, after which a Russian operative was overheard in a wiretap conversation telling his superiors that Page was an idiot. As a Trump campaign aide, Page traveled to Moscow for 3 days in July 2016. While there, he gave a speech harshly criticizing the Obama administration's foreign policy toward Russia and met with officials at Rosneft, a state-run oil company. The FBI obtained a secret order to wiretap Page in October after he had left the campaign. That warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has become one of the most controversial parts of the investigation. Why is it controversial? The FBI used portions of the so-called Steele dossier, which was funded by the Democratic Party, in its wiretap warrant application. Between June and December 2016, former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele wrote a series of 17 memos alleging a well-developed conspiracy in which the Russians would try to help Trump win the election and in return get U.S. sanctions relief and other favorable policies. The memos also claimed the Russians had financial and personal kompromat they could use to blackmail Trump. Steele primarily based his report, which he later called raw intelligence, on his long-standing sources in Russia. Steele did this work for Fusion GPS, a research firm retained by the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign. Believing that Russia had the ability to blackmail Trump and that this posed a national security threat, Steele took his findings to the FBI. Was the dossier legitimate? The Steele dossier's most sensational claims have never been confirmed. That includes the infamous P-tape of Trump allegedly frolicking with prostitutes in Moscow during the Miss Universe pageant in 2013. Some claims have been disproved by the Mueller report, but that investigation also found that Steele's overall claim of a Russian attempt to influence the election on Trump's behalf was on target. Trump has said the FBI's use of this crooked Hillary pile of garbage should discredit the entire Russia investigation. The Crossfire Hurricane team, however, didn't receive the dossier until September 2016, months after it had begun the investigation. Was the probe warranted? After Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, citing this Russia thing, Special Counsel Robert Mueller conducted a two-year investigation that concluded that Russia had interfered in the 2016 presidential election in a sweeping and systematic fashion. Mueller found that several people close to Trump, including Manafort and longtime confidant Roger Stone, had had dozens of contacts with Russians and were receptive to offers of help. Mueller also found 10 instances in which Trump personally may have obstructed justice in trying to limit or shut down the investigation. Republican Senator Marco Rubio, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said the committee's work had convinced him that the FBI had no choice but to begin a probe. There was a growing body of evidence that a foreign government was attempting to interfere in both the process and the debate surrounding our elections, Rubio said. The FBI's job is to investigate counterintelligence. That's what they did. Our first column this week continues in the same vein as the controversy of the week. It's titled, Is Trump a National Security Threat? The Pentagon and U.S. intelligence officials see President Trump as a national security risk, said Jonathan Chait. That harrowing little detail was tucked deep into a New York Times story this week on a new cyber offensive the U.S. has mounted against Russia, in which malware had been inserted in that country's power grid as a deterrent to another attack on our elections. Trump, the Times reported, had not been briefed in any detail on that operation for concern over his reaction and the possibility that he might countermand it or discuss it with foreign officials. Think what this means. Despite the Mueller report's investigation into potential crimes, we still do not know if Moscow has secret leverage over Trump. Well into the presidential campaign, Trump continued to negotiate with Russia over a condo tower in Moscow while publicly denying it. That gave Russia blackmail leverage over him. But were there other, even more damaging transactions between Trump and Russia? Trump won't ever criticize Putin, and has five times met with the Russian dictator in unusually secret conditions, refusing to let aides attend and once confiscating a translator's notes. Our intelligence agencies have good reason to worry about where Trump's loyalties lie. Democrats' debates may really matter. The Democratic debates will matter a lot, said Julian Zelitzer. The party's top 20 presidential candidates will face off in two separate groups of 10 on consecutive nights, and the groupings may change the dynamics of the race. Senator Elizabeth Warren is in the first group on June 26, with mostly second and third tier rivals such as Senator Cory Booker and Governor Jay Inslee, with only Beto O'Rourke truly posing a real threat to steal the spotlight. But by going in that first group, Warren gets a chance to establish herself as the progressive alternative to former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden will be in the June 27th group, clustered with tough, higher-polling competitors such as Bernie Sanders, Senator Kamala Harris, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. They are all sure to train their fire on Biden in an effort to trim his early poll lead. The media sometimes makes too much of any single campaign development, but these early debates could be pivotal. In a field this crowded, they could have a very significant influence on elevating candidates and helping Biden's opponents gain more traction against him. The preliminaries are over. Voters now will get a chance to see the candidates perform under pressure. Now it's time for the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is How My Son Joined the Alt-Right. My teen got sucked into an internet wormhole of angry propaganda aimed at disaffected males, said a mother, writing anonymously in the Washington Magazine. It took our empathy and a stranger's courage to get him out. When my son Sam is a pseudonym to protect the child's identity. When Sam asked me to take him to the mother of all rallies in September 2017, I said no. The pro-Trump event was billed as a demonstration to preserve traditional American culture, and white supremacists were expected to show up in force. At Charlottesville's Unite the Right rally only a month earlier, a neo-Nazi had killed counter-protester Heather Heyer. How had we gotten here? The problems had started when Sam was 13, barely a month into eighth grade. In the taxonomy of our local public school, his close group of friends was tagged edgy and liberal. Their group text chain pulsed 24/7 with observations about alternative music and the robotic conformity of other classmates. Standard stuff for sensitive middle schoolers. One morning during first period, a male friend of Sam's mentioned a meme whose suggestive name was an inside joke between the two of them. Sam laughed. A girl at the table overheard their private conversation, misconstrued it as a sexual reference, and reported it as sexual harassment. Before long, Sam was in the office of a male administrator who informed him that the exchange was illegal, hinted that the police were coming, and delivered him into the custody of the school's resource officer. At the administrator's instruction, that man ushered Sam into an empty room, handed him a blank sheet of paper, and instructed him to write a statement of guilt. At a meeting 2 days later with my husband, Sam, and me, the administrator piled more accusations on top of the harassment charge, even implying, with undisguised hostility, that Sam and his friend were gay. He waved in front of us a statement from the girl at the table and insisted that Sam would need to defend himself against her claims if he wanted to prove his innocence. He declared that it was his primary duty as a school official and as a father of daughters, to believe and to protect the girls under his care. Our son sat pale and trembling as he made his case. I wanted to reach out and hold his hand, but he was at the other end of the large conference table, a raft, it seemed to me, floating unprotected in a stormy sea. Sam agreed reluctantly to write a letter of apology to the girl who'd reported him so that the debacle would come to an end. But no hoped-for resolution materialized. Instead, Sam's sweet earnestness, his teenage overconfidence, even his tremulous determination in the face of unjust authority drained away, replaced by nothing. He lost all affect. He couldn't concentrate, turned in no homework, and didn't even pick up a pen when it was time to take a test. He didn't say much to us, but it seemed obvious enough that he felt betrayed by the adults he'd trusted. My husband and I felt betrayed, too. We agreed that if we'd lost confidence in the administrators in charge, withdrawing Sam was our only option. But the transfer mid-year to a new school after we'd been wrongly accused, unfairly treated, then unceremoniously dropped by his friends, shattered Sam. He felt totally alone. I counseled patience, naively unprepared for what came next, when he found people to talk to on Reddit and 4chan. Those online pals were happy to explain that all girls lie, especially about rape, and they had lots more knowledge to impart. They told Sam that Islam is an inherently violent religion and that Jews run global financial networks. We're Jewish and don't know anyone who runs anything, but I guess the evidence was convincing. They insisted that the wage gap is a fallacy, that feminazis are destroying families, that people need guns to protect themselves from government incursions onto private property. Who was living upstairs in the room with the bunk beds, surrounded by glow-in-the-dark solar system decals? I couldn't understand how this had happened. Teachers and family friends had always commented on Sam's kindness and especially his gentleness toward the underdog. Then an internet chorus of alt-right sirens sang their song of American History X to my kid. The pendulum had swung, and now it was stuck. The moments where Sam and I found common ground became increasingly rare. Although he had legitimate reasons to feel aggrieved, it was impossible for him to make sense of his situation or to trust that time would heal the hurt. Soon Sam stopped trying to persuade me to join his brave new world. He was so active on his favorite subreddit that the other group leaders, unaware that he was 13, made him a moderator. The top moderators aimed to approve 100 posts a day, and Sam took it as seriously as a paying job. His grades suffered, he sacrificed sleep, and stress blackened his mood. When he did talk to us, he fixated on topics like hacking and doxing. We countered all of Sam's off-kilter theories with data and introduced him to people whose views might outweigh ours. We also took him to movies, signed him up for rock climbing, bribed him to play with his baby cousins, and insisted he continue to join us at the dinner table. Anything to extract him from the echo chamber. The most insignificant outings were preceded by Camp David-level negotiations. Most of the time, we lost. So when Sam asked me to go to the mother of all rallies, not just once but over and over, stressing that he'd been an observer, that he'd be an observer, not a participant, I eventually relented. After the catastrophe in Charlottesville, I certainly wasn't going to let him go alone. Anyway, it was a chance to spend the day together. It had been ages since we'd done that. The morning of the rally, Sam and I arrived at the Washington Monument around 8:30, more than an hour early because Sam has always been anxious about getting to places on time. We sat on a marble bench and people watched as rallygoers gradually filled the plaza. As we made our way to the makeshift stage for speakers, Sam decided he wanted to interview as many people as he could. During the next hour and a half, he approached anti-fascist demonstrators, heavily accessorized neo-Nazis, a man draped in the green Keck banner common in alt-right memes, and a guy who claimed to work for a Republican senator. He recorded the conversations with his phone while I stood a few feet away. He usually asked one question, "Why are you here today?" and let the person speak until they were all men, was finished. As he debriefed me, he spoke almost as if he were seeing a negative of the person he'd been taping. One neo-Nazi in his early 20s was internally inconsistent, Sam said, because he was wearing an iron cross as well as an anarchy pin. Plus, the guy was almost totally incoherent. The Keck patriot, who had created a uniform and a flag for a fake state and then marched around in the dust like a toy soldier, seemed to Sam a ridiculous waste of time. So here they were, the star players from Reddit and 4chan, reconstituted in human form on the Mall. And none were as convincing, witty, or transgressive as they had presented themselves online. Even Sam's biggest Reddit hero, an African-American Nazi who posed with him for a selfie, wasn't as personable as he'd expected. Toward the end of our walk down the mall, I spotted a middle-aged man who stood alone on the grass, holding a small poster that featured a picture of a smiling Heather Heyer, the demonstrator murdered in Charlottesville. He'd magic markered the words, "A True American Patriot," and "Seville" under her photo, above a hand-drawn heart. I asked if I could take his picture, but it was hard to choke out the words because I started crying. I called Sam over and told him, in front of the man, that standing up for your beliefs among such a large, unfriendly crowd is the definition of courage. Sam seemed to understand. I could tell by the way he shook hands with the man slowly and deliberately, as if they were each transferring something to the other. As we walked to the metro, I thanked Sam for persuading me to go to the rally so I could be reminded of what real bravery looks like. I never would have believed someone could have the guts to stand alone like that, here of all places, I told him. I'm so glad I saw it for myself. That's what you always tell me to do, Sam said. In the months that followed, Sam very gradually began to act like the kid he had been before he was falsely accused of sexual harassment. He texted more with his classmates than with online strangers, and every few weekends I drove him to sleepovers with other kids. I noticed that when his new group of friends and said goodbye to one another, even the boys hugged. As for me, I was shell-shocked, glad the crisis was over, but struggling to come to terms with what had transpired. My cousin, one of the few people I had confided in, suggested that I read Kill All Normies, in which Angela Nagel tracks the rise of the online alt-right during exactly the period Sam fell under its spell. I discovered how expertly extremists have leveraged the web to prey on young people who are depressed. There need to be public warnings about this, said Twitter user at Mr. Happy Die Happy in one piece I read. Online pals have attempted to groom me multiple times when at my absolute lowest. One night last fall, I left a stack of articles on Sam's bed when he wasn't around. The story about how the alt-right purposely recruits depressed kids was on top. Before long, Sam was at my door. Then he was curled up next to me. "Did you hate me when I was hostage to the cult?" he asked. I'd never heard him use that phrase before. "I didn't hate you," I said after a minute. I sensed this was a test, and if I passed, something important was waiting for me. I was just baffled. "I hated myself," Sam admitted. "I felt trapped. Now I feel so stupid." He started sobbing, raggedly, struggling to catch his breath. Why would adults want to do that? Why would they want to fool kids? How could I fall for it? We talked about it every day for the next few weeks. He helped me understand how his anger and confusion over being falsely accused had fueled everything that happened next. "All I wanted was for people to take me seriously," Sam told me. "They treated me like a rational human being, and they never laughed at me. I saw the way you and Dad looked at each other and tried not to smile when I said something. I could hear you both in your room at night, laughing at me." I struggled for a moment because I wanted to tell him that wasn't true, but I couldn't deny his accusation. Behind closed doors, when my husband and I thought our children were asleep, we had often vented to each other about Sam's off-the-wall proclamations. So I told Sam simply that I was sorry for making him feel bad. I still think about his words a lot, especially when alt-right figures headline the news. But mostly, I wonder how I could have tried so hard to parent Sam through this crisis and yet tripped up on something as basic as not making my own kid feel small. Thankfully, Sam moved on. By the fall of 10th grade, he seemed at peace for the first time since he'd stepped off the bus almost 2 years earlier, face puffy from crying, to inform me he'd broken the law. That's why my fears came roaring back when Sam and I heard on the radio one day that another mother-of-all rallies was taking place on the mall that very weekend, and Sam asked if we could go together. My breath caught. He must have seen my change, my face change. As counter-protesters, he asked, eyes gleaming. This was excerpted from a story originally published in Washington Magazine. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The poor little rich girl who built a fashion empire. Gloria Vanderbilt, 1924 to 2019. Gloria Vanderbilt lived a life of tragedy and triumph worthy of the great American novel. At age 10 in 1934, the heiress was thrust into the spotlight in a custody trial that gave Depression-era America a glimpse of the lives of the ultra-rich. Vanderbilt was taken from her beloved nanny and placed with an icy aunt. She later said the rest of her life was a restless search for love. Married four times, she also had affairs with Errol Flynn, Marlon Brando, and Frank Sinatra. Vanderbilt finally found happiness with husband number four, writer Wyatt Emery Cooper, father of her youngest son, CNN journalist Anderson Cooper. But the marriage ended with his death at age 50. All that heartbreak made the beautiful Vanderbilt a gossip column favorite. She used that celebrity to turn her name into a brand that she slapped on linens, perfumes, and a line of figure-hugging jeans that became a $150 million a year business. I have no respect for anyone who has self-pity, Vanderbilt said in 2000. Nobody is spared in life. She was born in New York City to Reginald Claypool Vanderbilt, an alcoholic gambler and great-grandson of railroad baron Cornelius Vanderbilt and his wife, Gloria Morgan, a teenage socialite less than half his age, said the Washington Post. Following Reginald's death at age 45 in 1925, little Gloria was left with a nanny while her mother partied her way across Europe, funding her adventures with her daughter's $2.5 million trust fund. Scandalized, paternal aunt Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney sued for custody of the girl. Lurid testimony riveted the nation during a nearly two-month trial. A nurse described Gloria's mother as a cocktail-crazed dancer. A French maid raised the specter of lesbianism. Custody of young Gloria, called a poor little rich girl by the tabloids, eventually passed to Aunt Gertrude, who sent the child to her Long Island estate while she remained in the city. At age 17, Vanderbilt dropped out of school to join her mother in Beverly Hills. She was soon a glamorous figure on the Hollywood party circuit, said the New York Times. She had flings with film stars and Howard Hughes, and in 1941 married actor's agent Pasquale De Chico, who beat her frequently. Following their divorce in 1945, the 21-year-old Vanderbilt married conductor Leopold Strakowski, 63, with whom she had two sons. Vanderbilt was 30 and a budding stage actress when she left the controlling Strakowski, inspired by an affair with Sinatra, who she said created a kind of magic. She married film director Sidney Lumet in 1956, and soon after their relationship ended in 1963, she wed Cooper, with whom she had two sons, Carter and Anderson. Vanderbilt adored Cooper, said the Los Angeles Times. He taught her, she said, what the loving parenting I'd never had could be like. Cooper died in 1977 after a series of heart attacks. The same year, she launched her high-fashion jeans tailored for women with normal, not model-thin bodies. The elegant heiress starred in an advertising blitzkrieg that showed off her denim-clad derriere. And by 1979, her line had surpassed Calvin Klein jeans in sales. Tragedy struck again in 1988 when she witnessed her 23-year-old son, Carter, leap to his death from her own 14th floor terrace. It was, she wrote in her 1996 memoir, A Mother's Story, the final loss, the fatal loss that stripped me bare. But she remained a redoubtable force, and in 2009, the 85-year-old Vanderbilt published a steamy novel, Obsession. Asked about the book, her son Anderson said, "The six most surprising words a mother can say to her son are, 'Honey, I'm writing an erotic novel.'" We're on the health and science page now, starting with the deep ocean is filled with microplastics. The increasing amount of plastic pollution in our oceans is well documented, but a new study suggests the problem may be far worse than previously thought. Using underwater robots off California's central coast, researchers found that microplastics, tiny fragments of partially broken down plastic bags, bottles, and other products, were pervasive not only on the water's surface, but also thousands of feet below it. In fact, there may be at least as much microplastic in the deep ocean as there is in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the infamous floating mass of plastic trash that covers an area twice the size of Texas. Sampling water at depths ranging from 16 to 3,280 feet, the researchers discovered microplastics at every level. To their surprise, they found that the highest concentrations were neither on the surface nor at the deepest point, but between 600 and 2,000 feet down. At those depths, plastic concentrations were four times what they were near the surface. The team also found plastic particles in red crabs, which are eaten by larger fish such as tuna, tadpole-like larvacenes, and other deep-sea marine creatures. "We found microplastics everywhere we looked, in every sample and specimen," lead author Anela Choi tells NationalGeographic.com. Choi said the findings need to be replicated in other parts of the ocean to see whether they hold up. The area they examine is actually considered relatively clean. The health scare of the week: sleeping with the lights on. Don't drop off in front of the TV. It might make you fat. That's the conclusion of a new study that found sleeping with the television or light on was closely linked with weight gain. Researchers followed 43,722 healthy women ages 35 to 74 for about 5 years. After controlling for diet, physical activity, and other factors, scientists found that the participants who slept with an artificial light source on nearby were 17% more likely to have gained 11 pounds over the study period than those who slept in darkness. They were also about 30% more likely to become obese. The researchers suspect that artificial light may affect levels of appetite-regulating hormones or cause daytime drowsiness that results in people being less active. "Getting a good night's sleep is really important for health," senior author Dale Sandler from the National Institutes of Health tells the New York Times. "A very simple thing people can do to reduce the risk for obesity is to turn off the lights before going to sleep." And we are on the Talking Points page, starting with the article that refers back to that cover drawing. It's titled, "Overtourism, a New Global Complaint." Throughout Europe this summer, the most popular vacation destinations have a message for tourists, said Phil Boucher in Fortune.com. "Sorry, we're full." Perennial tourist magnets such as Venice, Barcelona, Amsterdam, Prague, and Dubrovnik have all been inundated with millions of selfie stick-toting tourists jamming attractions, clogging streets, and driving the locals mad. Take Barcelona, which had 1.7 million tourists in 1990. In 2018, 32 million poured into the city. The population is 1.6 million. And now its residents are actually staging protests against rampant tourism and what it's doing to the local beaches, landscape, and rental prices. Or consider the plight of Venice, said Kara Fox in CNN.com. In 2017, 36 million tourists flooded the iconic canal-filled city from April to October. Some 32,000 cruise ship passengers disembarked there daily, joining 465,000 day trippers. Residents must suffer the indignity of Americans asking, "What time does the city close?" as if it were Disney World. Officials have brought in turnstiles to restrict the movements of visitors and now plan to charge day trippers an $11 entrance fee. Overtourism is suddenly everywhere, said Annie Lowry in TheAtlantic.com. In May, beleaguered workers at the Louvre staged a one-day walkout to protest massive crowds they say have made the place dangerous and unmanageable. On the Spanish island of Mallorca, fed-up residents greet tourists at the airport with picket signs reading, "One flight every minute is not sustainable." Overtourism isn't just a complaint. It can be quantified with data, said Leonid Brzezinski in Bloomberg.com. In 2018, global tourist arrivals reached 1.4 billion, nearly tripling from 1995. The European Parliament now classifies 105 places as suffering from overtourism. There are plenty of reasons. The cruise industry, Airbnb, a rising global middle class, and of course, the main cause, the incredible ease and low cost of air travel. Allow me to suggest a solution, said Jason Horowitz in the New York Times. While the famous destinations like Venice and Amsterdam now look like mosh pits in the summer, smaller overlooked neighbors like Treviso, Italy, provide a proverbial oasis next door. Treviso has its own canals, exceptional tiramisu, worthy of the city in which the dessert was born, and many other charms. And it's only a half hour's train ride from Venice. Such places exist all over Europe, and surely the world. You just need to look. The religious right, reconsidering democracy. Anguished by their defeats in the culture wars, some religious conservatives are beginning to wonder whether liberal democracy's time has passed, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. In a recent article in the religious journal First Things, Catholic writer Sohrab Ahmari bluntly accuses libertarian-leaning conservatives of enabling liberals' degradation of American society. Too many conservative intellectuals, Ahmari argues, have passively accepted the left's victories on such issues as same-sex marriage and transgender rights out of a misguided concern over civility and individual liberty, leaving the Christian-braced moral order teetering on the edge of total destruction. Conservatives must fight the culture war with the aim of defeating the enemy, he writes, imposing their worldview on the country by any means necessary so as to serve the highest good. Ahman has a point, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com. Progressives are bent on utter and total destruction of everything American Christians hold dear, including even their right to express their offensive views in public. It's time for social conservatives to accept that we have reached a point in America where politeness and decency is no longer the best approach to politics. That's why so many Christians have embraced Trump's more brutal approach to politics. Sorry, but if conservatives go down this path, they're just as bad as the leftists they disdain, said Stephen Greenhut in Reason.com. Amari doesn't say exactly how he would impose his vision of morality on the country, but what needn't take too many leaps to see where this populist religious conservatism is headed. "I'm flummoxed by this debate," said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. "Conservatives control the presidency, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, and Trump is installing dozens of far-right Christian judges in federal courts. Nevertheless, social conservatives feel apoplectically embattled." It's worth noting that Amari started this debate after being triggered by an advertisement for a drag queen story hour for children at a public library, an event he called demonic. Do Christians really face an existential threat because drag queens are no longer universally reviled? What really infuriates Amari and people like him is that he now has to live in a society where his social and religious views no longer dictate how other people live. When one is accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And we'll see if we can get in a couple of short notes. The highly successful U.S. women's national soccer team generated about $50.8 million in revenue, mostly from ticket sales, compared with $49.9 million for the less successful men's national team from 2016 to 2018. In March, the 28 members of the U.S. women's team filed a lawsuit alleging that the U.S. Soccer Federation pays them less than the men's team. And we'll go on to a finishing quote for the day. This comes from Thomas Jefferson. He says, "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say that there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number here is 919-832-5138.